Blog Talk Radio.
You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray, run on.
Welcome to Our Common Ground. I'm Janice Graham, your host. Thank you for being with us tonight, speaking truth to power and ourselves. Our Common Ground, talk that matters.
We declare our right on this earth to be a man, to be a human being, to be respected as a human being, to be given the right of a human being in this society, on this earth, in this day, which we intend to bring into existence by any means necessary.
Our Common Ground. Thank you so much for being with us here at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Graham, your host, and we are pleased to be with you on this Saturday night, April 2nd, 2011. Hope you are doing well, that spring is catching up with you, and that it's looking more that you'll be able to spend time outdoors. I think that sun and I'm not sure if we get any fresh air much, but better than being tacked inside. Hope you all are well, and hope that your families are well, and that your children are smiling and laughing. That is the sign of a very healthy child. If your children are not smiling, laughing, imagining, then it is time for you to have a talk with yourself and do some self-examination, and then spend some time with your child finding out how you turn on the health of a child. I do want to tell you here at Blog Talk Radio, Blog Talk Radio has had some serious technical difficulties today. All throughout the day, Alpha, who will be joining us later, at the Alpha show on TruthWorks Network, was barely able to get through his show because of server problems here at Blog Talk Radio. So for those of our regulars who usually try and have a good discussion going about this broadcast, we want you to know that you can go to our Ning site, where we have our Common Ground chat room open and available to you, because here at Blog Talk Radio, we're unable to open up a chat room, and I think that that's probably not the priority for Blog Talk Radio tonight. Getting the shows back up would be the proper thing. Let me give you that address. That address is ourcommonground-talk.ning.com. If you want to gather for discussion about the broadcast, the chat room at Our Common Ground with Janice Graham is open tonight, because we are unable to initiate the chat room function at the Blog Talk Radio site. The address again is ourcommonground-talk.ning.com. At the top of the page, you will see OCG chat. Along the top of the strip of the page, you'll see the main page, invite, my page, members, photos, OCG archives, forum, blogs, videos, TruthWorks Network, and then OCG chat. If you click on that link, that is a link, it is blue. If you click on that link, it will take you to our chat room client right on our site. See, for those of you who have not signed up at Our Common Ground to receive our notifications, we did send out notifications to all of our members earlier this evening to let you know we were having difficulties at Blog Talk Radio and that you should come to this site. I'll be announcing it throughout the program. Usually I'm always providing titles of books, titles of authors, resources, sources, references, and links to resources on the web about the issues and topics during the course of our broadcast. Tonight I will try to do that as much as I can and hope that you can catch up with us at Our Common Ground talk.ning.com. That is where we have opened up our chat room for you this evening, and it is available for you. Tonight at Our Common Ground, we are terribly saddened by the passing and the transition of Dr. Manning Marable, who has been both a friend to this program, a frequent guest and contributor over the years. Dr. Marable made his transition yesterday in the afternoon in New York City, and we're going to be talking about his contribution to all of us. And for those of you who do not know him, I hope that you will have a great deal of understanding of how tremendously significant this loss is. I have known Manning Marable since we were college students. And, you know, there was a very small community of college students, and I have had a great deal of regard and respect both for him professionally as well as a great deal of love and regard and respect personally, and we hope you'll stay with us. Also, in our second hour tonight, we're going to be talking about juvenile or youth prisons and looking at an NPR report that should make you shiver. How prisons for youth, for young offenders, are really no different than prisons for adults. And they are set up for penalty against our young people and profit. That is all that we will be covering here at Our Common Ground tonight. We hope that you will stay with us. We are, as always, speaking truth to power and ourselves.
Tonight on Our Common Ground, we'll be remembering the warrior scholar, Dr. Manning Marable.
Sweetheart, I ask no more than this. A kiss, the bell, a dream on. Give me a kiss before you leave me, and my imagination will feed my hungry heart.
In our second hour, youth prisons in America, we'll be visiting one of the largest youth prisons in America in Grove, Mississippi. Is it penalty and profit on the backs of our children?
I'll be with you, weaving romances, making believe they're true. Oh,
This is Our Common Ground. I'm Janice Grant, speaking truth to power. Stay tuned and thank you for being with us. I'll be listening for you.
What you alone can give against the bill of demons.
And thank you once again for being with us. You're tuned in to Our Common Ground. In this first hour, we're going to be talking about our loss of a warrior scholar, Dr. Manning Marable. Manning Marable is a professor of history and political science and director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies, specializes in African American history. He was and is one of the most important historians of our time. He was the founding director of the Center for Contemporary Black History, established in 2002, and the Institute for Research in African American Studies, where he served from 1993 to 2003. He was a prolific author. Marable's work include Beyond Black and White, Race in America's Past, Present, and Future, published in 1995, The Crisis of Color and Democracy, also published in 1995, which was awarded the Book of the Year by the Gustavus Myers Center for the Study of Human Rights in 1996. The Great Wells of Democracy, The Meaning of Race in American Life, published in 2003. He was the author of Freedom, a photographic history of the African-American freedom struggle, which he co-edited with Leif Mullins, his wife, and Sophie Spencer Wood. And he was also the author of 9/11 Racism in a Time of Terror, which appeared in the winter edition of Souls magazine. He received his BA degree from Earlham College and his PhD from the University of Maryland. Prior to coming to Columbia, Dr. Marable taught at the University of Colorado at Boulder and Ohio State University, where he was the chairman of the Department of Black Studies. He also served as the founding director of the Africana and Hispanic Studies program at Colgate University. I want to remind those of you who are listening how difficult it is and was, especially during the time of this great development of scholastic inquiry, illumination, in universities and colleges to develop a black studies program. Professor Marable is a national leader in the development of web-based educational resources on the African American experience. With Columbia Center for New Media Teaching and Learning, he has directed the production of two courses on W.E.B. Du Bois and Malcolm X, respectively. A multimedia version of Du Bois' The Soul of Black Folks was produced by him in 2001. And there is a massive multimedia version of the autobiography of Malcolm X featuring 440 historical annotations, 78 newsreel and film clip footage of Malcolm X, 216 photographs, over 200 government documents and original oral history interviews with Malcolm's friends and associates. In 2005, Dr. Marable and members of his Malcolm X Biography Project designed the content for the multimedia education kiosk featured at the Malcolm X and Dr. Betty Shabazz Memorial and Educational Center. And that is located at the historic Audubon Ballroom in Manhattan, the site of Malcolm X's 1965 assassination. In 2002, Dr. Marable established the Center for Contemporary Black History at Columbia University. It was and still is an advanced research and publication center that examines black leadership in politics, culture, and society. The CZBH produces Souls, which is a quarterly academic journal of African American studies for which I was privileged to be invited to write about 3 years ago, and it is published and distributed internationally by Taylor and Francis Publishers. With the support of the Open Society Institute, the Soros Foundation, the Center for Contemporary Black History, African Criminal Justice Project has conducted a national survey of black studies departments to promote the development of new courses on race, crime, and justice. It has compiled hundreds of original texts in an African American archives examining the meaning of justice throughout black history, and taught courses on hip-hop culture and critical criminology inside Rikers Island Correctional Facility in New York City. CCBH also directs the digital knowledge production of black studies educational resources. Since 1976, Dr. Marable has written a political commentary series, Along the Color Line, that appears in over 400 newspapers and journals worldwide. He is a regularly featured in national and international media. He donates much of his time fundraising and speaking on behalf of prisoners' rights, labor, civil rights, faith-based institutions, and other social justice organizations. He lectured annually in Sing Sing Prison, Ossining, New York, in a master's degree program for prisoners. He is a prolific author since earning his Ph.D. degree 3 decades ago. He has written almost 200 articles in academic journals and edited volumes. He has written and or edited 21 books and scholarly anthologies. He was the founder, leader, and developer of the Malcolm X Project at Columbia University, which I mentioned earlier. Since its inception in 2001, the Malcolm X Project has been the world center of research and illuminating the life and work of the charismatic figure Malcolm X. Dr. Manning is one of America's most influential and widely read scholars, and even in his transition, he remains so. Since 1993, Manning Marable has been professor of public affairs, political science, history, and African American studies at Columbia University. For 10 years, Dr. Marable was founding director of the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University from 1993 to 2003. And under his leadership, the Institute became one of the nation's most prestigious centers of scholarship on the Black American experience. We recommend to you that if you want to know Dr. Manning Marable, that you listen to, and they are available, many of his lectures about Malcolm X, about black leadership, about black politics, about the state of black America on YouTube and other places, including Democracy Now!, including the Malcolm X Project site, including the many sites, Columbia Education, Columbia.education for the Malcolm X Project, He was born in Dayton, Ohio. And on May 13th, 1950, and he passed away in New York City on April 1st, 2011. And tonight at our common ground, we're pleased to remember some of the lessons of Dr. Marable and the words and legacy through his tremendous work, passion, and love for black people that he left us. A very special yet sad note. The book that he has been working on for the past 3 years, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, will be released on this coming Monday. You're listening to Our Common Ground. I'm Janice Graham, and I am so very honored to be able to remember with you my friend, a contributor to Our Common Ground since its inception, a frequent guest of on our terrestrial radio show, and a personal friend. I met Dr. Manning Marable. He was a freshman at Earlham. I was a sophomore at Wellesley. And we met doing the work of prisoners' rights in America. Here is Dr. Manning Marable on race.
I've been asked to speak on the state of American race relations and the state of the African American community as we stand at the beginning of a new millennium. And as I thought about this topic, I thought that perhaps the best way to get into a discussion about the present state of race relations in the state of the African American community is to highlight a statement that was made exactly 100 years ago by the most prominent scholar of the black experience, W.E.B. Du Bois. In 1900, the great African American scholar and activist W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, "The problem of the 20th century is the problem of the color line." Dr. Du Bois' powerful prediction of a century ago that the entire world increasingly would be divided along boundaries of North versus South, between the industrialized, affluent, and powerful white populations of Europe and North America, and the underdeveloped, poor, and oppressed nations of Africa, Asia, Latin America, and the Caribbean, has largely come to pass. Now that we stand at the beginning of a new century and a new millennium, in this age of globalization, transnational corporations, post-industrial cities, and cyberspace technologies, the challenge for dismantling racism remains a fundamental challenge, not only in U.S. democracy, but in Western democracy. This thesis should in no way be interpreted as minimizing or underestimating the other destructive social forces that continue to divide U.S. society: sexism or gender oppression, homophobia, anti-immigrant hatred, and other forms of exploitation, especially economic or class inequality. Nevertheless, it is to state, and my thesis this evening is, that a democracy cannot exist. A democracy does not exist in a racially stratified society and in a context where millions of people, solely on the basis of the color of their skin, remain locked out of genuine opportunity and equality. Right on, thank you. The great challenge we have to face in the 21st century is the challenge of abolishing racism root and branch and creating a genuinely non-racist, pluralistic democracy and a human rights culture in this country. A human rights culture and a free and fair society with genuine material and economic opportunity and justice for all people. For us to eliminate racism, we must clearly and carefully define its character, explaining how and why a generation after the Civil Rights Movement, that race remains such a powerful factor, such a destructive force, that touches virtually every dimension of American contemporary life. We must have the courage to speak truth to power, that race has not magically declined in significance, that affirmative action is absolutely essential and necessary to redress both the historic and contemporary liabilities and barriers in the development and progress of black and brown Americans, that justice, quote unquote, of our police and courts and prisons has never been and is not to this day colorblind in the United States, that the African American still remains the last hired and the first fired, that the death penalty and life sentences without parole have become the new lynchings of the 21st century. We cannot have a democracy in a society that so viciously and cruelly mistreats those who live in the land of their birth and yet are denied the birthright or human right that millions of other people can casually take for granted. This is why it is so important for us in understanding the state of black America, to understand the state of race relations, that we must continually use as our touchstone an understanding of black history. Now, I say this in part because I'm a historian. This is my life's profession. But I think that it is particularly valuable for our discussion this evening. There is a direct connection between history and power, especially for the oppressed. Only a thorough knowledge of our past yields a critical appreciation of where we are as a people today and how and why certain arrangements of power that circumscribe and limit black advancement and human development have occurred in this country. We are always confronted and challenged by the past because of this central truth. Unless you know where you have been, how can you possibly know where you are going? Only the past can explain the present, yielding new possibilities for the future. Thus, black history and culture are essential for empowering black people today. For us to speak about black history and power and vision in a language that is articulated by such giants in the intellectual tradition of black folks, such as Carter G. Woodson and W.E.B. Du Bois and John Hope Franklin, helps us to discern what are the challenges in the future. Can we perceive ourselves, as our greatest black scholars have done, as not merely the interpreters of our experience, but as the creators of a new history? Toward that purpose, this evening, I would like to interrogate several topics or themes. First, let us consider the tension and the connections between the black past and the black present in the context of U.S. race relations. We're now a generation removed from the civil rights movement and the black power struggle of the 60s. What are the human dimensions that can be termed day-to-day racism that impacts millions of black people here in the 21st century? All of us in this room know that the signs reading white and colored that segregated black folk from white have been now taken down for a generation. It has been 35 years since the passage of the 1965 Voting Rights Act. It has been 36 years since the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act outlawing legal racial segregation. Yet, despite the passage of legislation and legal victories, despite the growth of a substantial and successful black middle class, the barriers to black equality nevertheless still exist. And we must first measure the textured patterns of racial oppression by first examining how we encounter racism in daily life and build from there to an analysis of structural and institutional racism that still exists in this country, even though the signs have been taken down. Second, we must document as a part of the new structural racism, the growing importance of what Angela Davis calls the prison industrial complex, the rapid expansion of prisons and police as a chief means of warehousing redundant labor and of social control within the black and Latino community of this country. Third, we must interrogate what I call the trap of color blindness. How conservatives and many liberals in this country insist that affirmative action is no longer necessary, that black people must forget about color, that we should strive to blend ourselves into the mainstream of white culture and society. Yet I will argue this evening that to be totally colorblind in a society that still remains coded and stratified by color is to perpetuate our own oppression. In order to cure a person of a cancer, you must first identify it in order to cut it out. In order to eliminate the malignancy of racism, you must first do what? Identify it. And then take corrective measures to eliminate it. If we are confused into believing that color has, and race has magically declined in significance, we will perpetuate our own subordination. Fourthly, we must overcome the trap of victimization, that black folk cannot succeed because we are only merely the victims of someone else's history. As historians of the black experience, we can help others to discover and cherish those strengths within our heritage and culture, providing the psychological and ontological foundations for personal development and collective struggle. When young African Americans understand truly what our people have accomplished, despite overwhelming odds against us, the future generation of African Americans will find the courage to move forward.
Dr. Manning Marable, one of America's most influential and widely read scholars. We'll hear more from Dr. Marable later on in this program. For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to Our Common Ground. At Blog Talk Radio, our chat room is not up because the function is not available to us, but you can join many of our regulars in our chat room at ourcommonground-talk.ning.com, and you'll find the whole crew there. Good evening, Alpho. How are you this evening? Thanks for joining me once again.
Good evening, Janice. I'm a little tardy, and I'm on the Ning site, and I don't see anybody. I can't find a thing, but that's my computer.
Okay, let me give some instructions about how to get there. At the top of the page at the Ning site, ourcommonground-talk.ning.com, you will see a strip with blue writing. It says Main Invite My Page. Almost at the end of that strip, at the top of the page, it says OCG Chat. That is a link that will take you to our chat room, and you will find YJ and Smooth Operator right there. They have found it, and I hope that all of you who are looking for the chat room tonight will find it. Tonight at Our Common Ground, we're remembering my dear and well-respected friend, Dr. Manning Marable. He is perhaps the most prolific historian of our time. We're going to go to our chat room, Alpho, and then you and I can chat up a little bit. 804, you've been waiting for a while. Thank you so much for joining us. I respect you.
Good evening. My name is Hugh. I'm calling from Virginia, and I was shocked. I just became aware of listening to your program about Dr. Marable's passing. I'm a white male. I'm a little bit older than him, but I did have some contact with him on a C-SPAN program that was March 24th, 2008. I called in when he was on the show, and I actually launched something that I called the Veterans Uniting America. I tried to interact with him, but he was so extremely busy, which I could appreciate. But I'm calling, too, to see if there are some things that can be investigated related to me, because I am trying to empower the black people as well as indigenous peoples from all around the world. And I do have some very interesting things in my personal background that should be looked at. I'm disabled. I don't have email, but there is a blog that has some initial information about me, and I hope that you can pull up that information that I just gave you about the C-SPAN television program. But this little blog has a letter from President Obama to me related to the economy, as well as a poem that's in the Ronald Reagan Library and an interview that may be downloaded. You can access that if you just Google creativity, the number 777.com. And hopefully you or somebody that you may have connections with can begin to pick up on me and see the documentation I have on things. I years ago exposed the former federal government bureaucrat for fraud via a front page Wall Street Journal article, and I have a lot of other things that would be of great interest, including...
Well, you can, as you can imagine, most of Dr. Marable's friends and colleagues are at this point stunned by his passing. And I would suggest that if you wait a little while, I'm sorry, what was your first name?
My name is Hugh, and I am working in many areas.
Suggest...
If I could just leave it in your archives or with you to at whatever point in time you want to pick up on me, that would be fantastic.
Well, I would suggest that probably the best way to continue is to contact the Institute for Research in African American Studies at Columbia University. I would give it a month or so, because there's got to be some reorganization and some reframing of the leadership of that group. The other thing that you can do, you say you don't have email. You can. Are you on the Blog Talk Radio site?
I have a web browser on my cell phone. That's how I came across the show that you have.
Oh, okay.
But I have more than enough. I'm looking for people to look at me. Whoever wants to, if they will just.
Well,
look.
I'm not a researcher, I'm not a scholar, but I would suggest that that's what you do, is that you go to the Dr. Marable.
I'm not going to pursue it, I'm just throwing something out there, but the bottom line in everything is love, and he gave a lot to humanity. And we should say prayers of thanksgiving for what he gave us.
You're absolutely right.
And if we will just, in his honor, begin to look within and ask the Creator to help guide us in our mission in this life and be caring and sharing with one another. And that little poem that's in the Ronald Reagan Library, I'll just leave at the end of this conversation. It's three lines long. And in memory of him, if we can just take it into our hearts and contemplate. It's titled Caring, Sharing. It goes, if you dare to care, then share. If you share, pay heed. God will reward every good deed. Thank you, Dr. Marable, and God bless everyone.
Okay, thank you very much for your call, Hugh. You know, Alpha, there's an African proverb that says, when an elder of wisdom transitions, it is a library burning. It is like much like a library burning down. And I certainly think that that is so fitting for my friend Manning Marable. He touched a lot of lives, but more than that, he wrote our stories. Someone wrote me on yesterday and said, what does it take to create Black Studies programs and research centers for Black history to write 21 books in a lifetime that are manuscripts of our history? And my response was, what it takes is an infinite amount of passion and wisdom to understand, as Manning Marable would say, history is the core of our power.
Well, Janice, as usual, I am a day behind and a dollar short on getting into this chat room. Is the chat room open, but it's got June 13th as a date, and it's frozen. Nothing. I can't get into this chat room. I've signed in.
Dela Proja is there, and Smooth Operator, and YJ. My suggestion to those of you who are having a hard time is to close the site and come back into the site and then go to the chat room. I'm trying to think. When you click on the chat link, there will be something that comes up that says join. You can't come away from that page. If you come away from that page, then you come away from the chat room. You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio has some difficulties and technical difficulties tonight. They had big server problems all during the day, and we can't use our chat function. So we've opened the chat room at ourcommonground-talk.ning.com, and you can go there and use the chat room there. We're going to take a break while Alpha tries to figure out how to get into our chat room, and when we come back, we'll listen more to our dear brother, Dr. Manning Marable, who transitioned on yesterday. I'm Janice Graham, and Alpha is my co-host of the Alpha Show tonight.
For us to eliminate racism, we must clearly and carefully define its character, explaining how and why a generation after the Civil Rights Movement, that race remains such a powerful factor, such a destructive force, that touches virtually every dimension of American contemporary life. We must have the courage to speak truth to power, that race has not magically declined in significance, that affirmative action is absolutely essential and necessary to redress both the historic and contemporary liabilities and barriers in the development and progress of Black and brown Americans, that justice, quote unquote, of our police and courts and prisons has never been and is not to this day colorblind in the United States, that the African American still remains the last hired and the first fired, that the death penalty and life sentences without parole have become the new lynchings of the 21st century. We cannot have a democracy in a society that so viciously and cruelly mistreats those who live in the land of their birth and yet are denied the birthright or human right that millions of other people can casually take for granted. This is why it is so important for us in understanding the state of Black America, to understand the state of race relations, that we must continually use as our touchstone an understanding of Black history. There is a direct connection between history and power, especially for the oppressed.
You're listening to Our Common Ground.
Here at Our Common Ground tonight, we're remembering the prolific historian, Dr. Manning Marable.
You know that the ice cream scoop can make a child smile, and that by slowing us down, the traffic light can keep us going. You know that the lawnmower makes life easier, that the blood bank makes life possible. But did you know all these ideas came from the minds of African Americans? Support the United Negro College Fund, because a mind is a terrible thing to waste. Visit uncf.org or call 1-800-332-UNCF. Brought to you by UNCF and the Ad Council.
If we looked into the eyes of evil, pure evil, and said to ourselves, what is this country coming to? What have these bigoted racists, and I'll repeat it, bigoted racists. Anybody wants to challenge me on that? Have at.
Reload some Alpha, the Mo Alpha Show on Truthworks Network. More of the Alpha Show, 4 p.m., Truthworks Network.
A kiss to build a dream on, and my imagination will thrive upon that kiss. Sweetheart,
you're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janet Graham, and my co-host is Alpha, the Alpha Show. Thank you so much for being with us. Our number is 347-838-9852. Tonight we're remembering, in this first page, our dear brother, the prolific author, scholar, warrior, activist, historian, Dr. Manning Marable of Columbia University. Alpha, thank you for being here with us. How you doing with that chat room?
It's not happening.
Well, YJ is telling you, it's time to get you a woman. You are getting older. Just follow the yellow brick road.
I've been on the yellow brick road.
Thank you, YJ, for that sage advice to Alpha. He has a woman, but he doesn't understand. I'm not as scared of him.
Oh, I keep telling you, it's you no scared of me.
You know, Alpha, I had to tell you this story. You know, I like to tell stories on the radio. Manning Marable caught my eye at a meeting of the Fortune Society in New York, bringing college students together for an orientation for working on the transformation and advocacy for prisoner rights in prisons in America. And we were pretty young, but the thing that caught my eye so about him across the room at this meeting, and this was like in 1967. He was a freshman at Earlham, and I was a sophomore. Even though he and I were born in the same year, he would have a birthday May 13th. He would have been 61 years old. when he transitioned on yesterday. He was 60. And the whole notion was this: there was a man in the room that could have been my father's twin at that age. And I just had to find out who he was. And from that date, he and I have enjoyed, though our careers have gone different ways, we worked for many, many years, for about 6 or 7 years with the Fortune Society, and then he went to Ohio State University after receiving his PhD at University of Maryland. And then he was at Fisk for a while, and he and I were in heavy contact while he was at Fisk, at the Fisk Institute for Race Relations. And I was really looking forward to, because I believe my granddaughter, even though she hasn't made her final decision, is going to be entering the freshman class at Columbia. I was really looking forward to being able to call him and say, guess what? Imani's coming to Columbia. And he had been writing notes and encouraging her to do so. But about 2 years ago, 3 years ago, he was on Our Common Ground when we were at U.S. Talk Network, and he wasn't well even then. I had booked him for a show, a second show, at U.S. Talk Network, and he had become ill. And he has really fought this disease and all of the symptoms over the last 2 years, valiantly and with lots of courage, lots of openness and saying goodbye, both to his staff at Columbia and to his family. He has three wonderful grandchildren, three wonderful children, a wonderful wife with whom he has not only shared the intimacy of a beautiful marriage, but the intimacy of his professional work. And that is such a nice thing to be able to remember in my mind. So I was saddened, but very much by this loss. This is a great loss to the nation, to academia, to the academy. You know, the scholars like to call themselves the great scholars like to call, and he was indeed a great scholar. He was authentic in every way, and I'm hoping that all of you will find a great black bookseller. His book, Malcolm X, A Life of Reinvention, will be released on Monday. He was able to see the book, to touch it. He was able to sign some of the books for very close friends like Dr. Michael Eric Dyson, members of the activist community, both at Columbia, throughout the academy, and many of the people who supported him in finishing this work. And one of the things that I got a notice from my bookseller, I pre-ordered the book, that the book will be delivered via UPS on Wednesday. And I pre-ordered my book maybe about 4 months ago. But one of the things in this book that's going to be so enlightening is the illumination over the issues related to the assassination of Malcolm X. Peter Bailey, who lives in Virginia, by the way, Hugh, was the personal assistant to Malcolm X at the time of his development of the African Unity Organization. and at the time of his assassination, has really been very intimately involved in assisting Dr. Marable in the development of this book. Peter Bailey, who has also been a very good friend to this broadcast over the years, has a number of interviews. And for those of you who want to catch some of those interviews, I suggest that you go to columbia.edu/cumxp. Just do a Google for the Malcolm X Project at Columbia University, and there is a great deal of the work that Dr. Marable has done over a period of since the assassination of Malcolm X, over the life. There's multimedia. The Malcolm X Project at Columbia was incepted in 2001, and it has been primarily concerned with gathering and illuminating new research through two major initiatives. One, the construction of a web-based multimedia version of the autobiography of Malcolm X, and two, the research and development of a biography of Malcolm X written by Dr. Manning Marable. The first initiative was completed in June of 2004, has been in a variety of Black Studies courses, and the research for the biography, A Life of Reinvention, was ongoing for a long time, and the book was scheduled to be published last fall, 2009. However, Dr. Marable's illness delayed the publication of the book, and the book will be released on Monday. Before we share with you some of, I want to share with you a clip that I have on Dr. Marable talking about terrorism, and I also want to share with you his thoughts on Malcolm X. We're going to go to our phones. 954, you're on the air. I respect you. Thank you for your call. 954? 954 keeps coming in and out. I don't know if that's a problem with Blog Talk Radio. For those of you who have joined us late, you're listening to Our Common Ground, and in this first page, we're remembering Dr. Manning, William Manning Marable. Here's what he had to say, some thoughts on Malcolm X.
The humanity of all people, regardless of color or race. Malcolm embraced this definition of Islam, and building from it came to the realization that the underlying tension and the fundamental challenge between people throughout the planet was not based on color, it was based on class. Malcolm said at the end of his life, "All my life I used to believe that the struggle was between white and black. Now I understand," he said, "that the fundamental struggle is between the haves versus the have-nots." So Malcolm X charted a path challenging structural inequality and economic injustice. And that was his message to the masses of blacks in the United States. It was a message that many middle-class African-American leaders have been afraid to embrace because of its revolutionary character. Malcolm was assassinated in part to silence the kind of evolution and the radicalism that he was undergoing. Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated 3 years later because he was undergoing a similar kind of transformation. That Dr. King came out against the war in Vietnam. He called for a poor people's march on Washington, D.C. to challenge the Johnson administration's failure to address the continuing burden of poverty in the society. Martin called for the need to internationalize the struggles of African Americans and to reach out to progressive people throughout the world to put pressure on the U.S. government for its unjust domestic and foreign policies. So he ends up being assassinated. So there is a long tradition in the United States of either assassinating black leaders or silencing them by stripping them of their citizenship rights or their right to travel, taking their passports away. This is what occurred in the 1950s with Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois, the founder of the NAACP, and the great Paul Robeson, who was a great artist and singer and actor, whose both of their passports were denied to them for 7 or 8 years. They were stripped of their right to travel throughout the world. Their income plummeted. And so there is this official, they were made non-persons, very much like under the old Soviet Union, of what occurred with people like Sakharov and Solzhenitsyn. So we have in the United States political prisoners that remain today incarcerated. We also have the disproportionate number of people who are in prison. Are very low-income people, and the criminal justice system works as a way of warehousing the unemployed. Of those 2.3 million people who are in prison, most of about a third of them were unemployed at the time of their arrests, and the others averaged less than $20,000 annual income in the year prior to their arrest. So the vast majority of people who are incarcerated in the U.S., regardless of what they've been charged with, are poor people, and they are disproportionately brown and black, but, they are poor people. And, so that the country continues to function in a way to suppress legitimate dissent. So this is part of why Malcolm is so important, because he symbolizes, in many real ways, a break with this kind of both white supremacy and economic injustice.
Your book on Malcolm X is titled A Life of Reinvention. What kind of reinvention are you talking about?
Malcolm continued to remake himself throughout his life. He was born Malcolm Little in Omaha, Nebraska. He, during the course of his life, he underwent a series of changes. When he was a teenager, his nickname was Detroit Red. He was involved in urban crime. He was a small petty gangster in Harlem during the 1940s. He was imprisoned for 7 years for several robberies. During his life in prison, he experienced an epiphany or a metamorphosis where he joined a sectarian Islamic group, the Nation of Islam, which combined elements of traditional Islam with kind of black separatism, headed up by the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. He became a devotee of this organization when he was released from prison in 1952. He emerged rapidly as a major figure within the group. He personally helped to establish over 60 mosques from 1952 to 1962. But in the course of his development, he came to realize the contradictions and problems inherent in this sectarian group, and also the hypocrisy and the contradictions of the leader who had engaged in extramarital affairs and also and corruption. And so Malcolm broke from the organization, building his own groups, Muslim Mosque Incorporated, which reached out to the Sunni community, and the Organization of Afro-American Unity, a secular group that attempted to mobilize African-Americans, regardless of their faith or religion, to engage in political struggle with the state, with the government. And this was really where Malcolm was going at the end of his life. So there are a series of changes. That's why the subtitle of the book is The Life of Reinvention. The listeners may want to access my website on Malcolm, which documents many of the interviews I've done. It's www.MalcolmXProject. That's one word, MalcolmXProject.net. And you can see many of the interviews and a lot of film clips and photographs of Malcolm X.
Excellent, thank you. Well, that was an era of great black leadership. Many of them were prominent and saw the problems of that time. What is left of this black leadership?
Well, today, the best example of black leadership is Barack Obama, who is currently the leading candidate for the Democratic nomination for president in the 2008 election. That it's a different kind of black leadership. It's what I call post-black leadership, in the sense that Malcolm X and Dr. King had constituencies. Their core constituencies consisted of African Americans. The same thing is true with Jesse Jackson, who ran for president in 1984 and in 1988. Jackson did reach out to whites in 88 in a very dramatic way, but nevertheless, the core of his vote consisted of blacks. That is not true with Barack Obama. Even though approximately 90% of all African Americans who are voting are supporting his candidacy, that was not true a year ago, where Hillary Clinton actually had a majority of black support in her competition with Barack Obama as late as December or January of this year. The Clintons really lost black support because of the racially unfair and hypocritical way that they ran their campaign, the kinds of attacks on Barack Obama, as well as the statements made both by Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton most recently, several days ago, that seemed to imply that she would benefit from the assassination of Barack Obama, that appalled and astonished millions of African Americans throughout the United States. Now, I understand that this was not her intent by the statement that she made regarding the death of Robert Kennedy in 1968, and drawing an allusion to that with Obama. I'm sure that she means him no physical harm. Nevertheless, she continues to run for presidency because she anticipates that something will disrupt Obama's campaign for the presidency. And one of those things that people have speculated widely about is his assassination. Given the history.
You know, Alpha, one of the things that we have to consider is that we have lost two major brain trusts in 2011, Dr. Ron Walters and now Dr. Manning Marable, who transitioned on yesterday at the age of 60. 954, you're on the air. I respect you. Thank you for your call.
Blessings and peace to you. And to
Ronde, good to hear from you.
Yes, ma'am. I recognize this gentleman's name from Alternatics. And this was not too long after the Willie Bosker case and just after Howard Beach and Eleanor Bumpus. And Alton Maddox and I, we only met that once. And he brought up the heroes and sheroes. We were eating off of Columbus Avenue, just to kind of give you a little historical perspective. And I says, well, I'm not aware of this, brother, but, you know, at that same time, I just picked up Hal Cruz's book. Was it? Plural, but equal or something
equal.
To that. It was like half the size of the dictionary. And I did go get the book, you know. So that is my only recollection of Mr. Manning about him and his legacy. And, you know, of course, Dr. Kenneth Clark and Dr. Ben and folks like this, you know, so I understand.
Well, I know that Dr. Ben and Dr. Clark were greatly respected men in Marable. And this is one of the books, a book that I read every year that Manning Marable wrote. The title is Speaking Truth to Power. And it really does,
right,
Aronde, talk about how we have to extract history and place the issues, contemporary issues, in front of us in the context.
Well, I don't know
history.
Anybody who's better equipped to do that than black folks, African Americans, that's been on the soil, not only for ourselves, but the masses of people.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot conjure up any other entity other than
well,
us.
Well, you know, one of the
soil.
Things, you have access to the web, and for those of you who are listening, if you really want to understand the work and how important and really devastating the loss of Dr. Marable is to us, it's just to do a Google of his series, his commentary series, Along the Color Line.
Well, I don't want to let it go at that, sis, because, you know, that's not the full fulcrum of my point here. I remember the Schoenberg collections, and that's the other point, which is right across from Harlem Hospital, you know, off of Lenox Avenue in New York City in Harlem. That's Harlem spelled with one R, y'all, you know? Those collections, and I'm not sure if his books are there, but I remember when that library, the Schoenberg collections, were moved from New Lincoln High School over to the new Schoenberg Library that's in Harlem right now today, which a lot of people, including Spike Lee and a lot of folks, have gone there and done their researches about everything from our history. And the thing is, this might be getting off the topic. I want to try and stay on topic with you.
Well, you seem to be a specialist in that.
What, staying on topic?
Getting off topic.
Listen. All right. Let me say this.
Let me just
mention
make
something
point
about Raytheon. Hold on. I got to say this to you, Janice.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Raytheon. We used to fly in the Raytheon over in the Ascension Islands. And I know what Raytheon was. I believe they bought out Signature. This is getting kind of off the subject. But the thing is that...
Why are you getting off the subject? And we're talking about something as important as one of the most significant historians, black or white, in this country. Past. Why are you talking about Raytheon?
Because you mentioned that at one time, and it made me reflect on that for some weird reason at this time. But it's, I'm like that at times, you know. And I try to explain that once to India. You know, I'm a little bit deteriorating.
Yeah, but that shows a disregard, Aronde.
No,
let's
ma'am. No,
that.
Ma'am. No, ma'am.
Okay.
No, ma'am.
I know you don't disregard me, and I know you don't.
And you know that. You
yes,
know that.
I do.
But the thing is,
my friend
at one point
died
in time,
yesterday.
But I know who you're talking about and who to attribute thanks and gratitude to, and I'm not that off base. But the thing is, I remember this gentleman's name because at the same time, and this is before Alton Maddox and I got to meet each other, when Mawa Karenga came with Kwanzaa in 67, 68, man, and the Black Liberation, the Zebra Hit Squad, and all these factions, Fred Hampton out of Chicago.
Come on, Aronde,
you know.
Make the point. What's the point?
All I'm saying is that this is, I respect what you're doing. I understand who the gentleman is as far as his name being recounted to me anyway. And the point is that is this. to your next topic in this. We can respect our people who are passing on and transitioning and leaving a legacy. But if we keep wallowing in the mire, if we don't make a real stand right now, and we ain't going to be all we can be in the damn Army or the Air Force and none of this crap and supporting the United States government. We're not. That's the point I'm making. And you may not want to hear that. And what do you think all these brothers were telling us? What do you think they were expounding on?
Exactly.
What do you think Malcolm and them
was
expounding
on? That's why it's important to know these people, to know the people who have done the work.
And I know a lot of people know that. So now what are you, not so much you, but what are other folks going to do? Because obviously you're doing the work by exposing this, but what actions are everybody else going to take to resolve our situation?
Well, I think that people do, you know, it's something that I pointed out, Aronde, last week on this broadcast. That when people know, the more they know, the more they understand. The more they understand, the more they self-reflect. The more they self-reflect, the more they see. The more they
because people are scared more so than ever before, because they've been lulled asleep.
Okay, but you
and
know
I'm
what?
I'm not trying to discount
Aronde,
you.
That's a show that. We'll have to do it another time because I've got to get to, I do want to get into youth, into this issue on youth prison, and I'm probably going to have to forego some of the stuff that I wanted to do, and I did. I had planned on talking about youth prisons for the full 2 hours, but because of the passing of Dr. Marable, I thought that it was important. People need to start, you know, for instance, when people like W.E.B. Du Bois died, if we had started then studying what the scholars had discovered, if we had started reading Angela Davis and the papers that she published during the time of her imprisonment, we might have more answers. You see what I'm saying?
Sister. The folks were doing that. I was reading George Jackson, Blood in My Eye, when Angela Davis was defending him.
There are a lot of people who are listening to this broadcast. You're unique. There are a lot of people listening
to this broadcast. No, I'm not unique.
You and I
are the same time, sis. This is what I can say.
I know.
You and I are the same time. We are. And you went to school in New England, so did I, for my last 2 years before I went to Vietnam, man. You know, what I'm telling you, and I'm talking about Stockbridge, when you could hitchhike. I was picked up by Norman Rockwell hitchhiking, having a clue who this cat was. But I figured out who he was later after I went back to my dorm. But the thing is this. No, there are a lot of people. No, we had too many heroes and sheroes in our lives. They know what time. We need to stop assuming that. What is being perpetuated in our society, this is why these prison systems are being perpetuated, that this is a normality. No, folks know what time it is. You know, we cannot keep evading to Dancing with the Stars on all that bovine. You know, black people in America, black people.
Yeah, but when we try to divert to something that's important, we get fractured by not focusing.
Yeah, but listen, we couldn't have gotten that fractured to get to this point. In
okay.
life.
I've got to go.
All right. We'll continue this point. All right.
I respect you, man.
Take care.
Let me recommend to everyone that's listening is that we begin to really study our history. Because one of the things, Dr. Marable was the general editor of Freedom on My Mind, the Columbia documentary history of the African-American experience in 2003. And one of the things that he insisted upon as both a scholar and an activist. He was a scholar warrior. He insisted upon is that our power is in knowing our history. Aronde, thank you.
Sister, how do you achieve your self-worth and power if you don't fight for it? Fighting for it means to be for it.
Aronde, that's another show.
All right, thank you.
We have open mic.
I respect.
When we have open mic, people, we can carry on various conversations. See, Alpha, we have to focus. I do want to get into our subject about youth prisons. I did put some of it off, and we'll certainly pick it up next week. But we also want to talk about some of the contemporary issues that Dr. Marable got into. Alpha?
I am here.
All of this is not in a vacuum. And
well,
I think that it's not enough for us to generalize and make sweeping statements about who we are and what we need to do. We have to somehow frame it in the context of not only our history, but also in the context of our strategies.
Well, Brother Aronde is always, his intentions are always on the good.
Absolutely.
And
I understand why he wants to talk about those things.
And his, I think, and, you know, it's like I'm getting to a point where I'm frustrated to a point of turning to a different approach, because it doesn't seem that a level of civility is enough. You can't reason with, you know, people who are unreasonable. And to take, I mean, they won't stand down, and many of our people won't stand up. And I think it's risen to a level of frustration. And that's what I hear with Brother Aronde, because he's traveled, he's seen, you know, so many various alternatives. And just like I had a discussion with Aronde about, you know, a topic, you know, when we could get our thoughts through on Blog Talk Radio. But Dr. Manning Marable is, I mean, quite frankly, Janice, I had never heard of this man. But from what I'm hearing this evening, I should have heard of this man.
Mm-hmm.
And that's
mm-hmm.
what's troubling me. That's what's more troubling to me than anything right now. Because Malcolm X, yes, I've, you know, heard of Malcolm X, and I've done, you know, a lot of, you know, looking up of his work. But this man seems to have been one of those quiet giants that stood in the background that nobody knew.
You see, the thing is, he was a quiet personality. He was knocking himself out to be on CNN, C-SPAN, and be the head of this. He was doing the deliberate work. He is the foremost historian on the life and the work of Malcolm X. He has studied black leadership over the past 100 years. He has looked at the strategies. He has compared them, done the critical analysis of why they worked, what didn't work. And also he's been an activist. I understand. I mean, nobody could be any more frustrated than I am with the inability to remove the apathy and the lethargic nature of how black people have been. Aronde says that they are afraid I think that there is some fear about it that's mixed in. But the other is, I think that people are confused. And one of the things that we tend to do is we're trying to focus our attention on one thing, and then we get all the other stuff mixed up in it, that people walk away and they think, especially in this audience, well, I don't know what that conversation was about, and I'm trying not to have that happen. Let's listen to Dr. Marable on terrorism. This is right after 9/11.
Organizations giving $1,000 or more to such a terrorist group is a criminal offense that could put you in jail for 5 to 7 years. Now, when you think about the fact that it was not too long ago that the African National Congress was defined by our government as a terrorist organization, when you think about the Southwest African People's Organization, SWAPO, when you think about Frelimo in Mozambique, when you think about liberation movements in El Salvador, Nicaragua, and the Sandinistas, if you think about the U.S. role in Grenada and the New Jewel Movement, all defined as terrorists, you see the great danger to civil liberties and to the pursuit of legal justice in this country through the Ashcroft-initiated just abrogation of civil liberties. The Democratic Party has almost to a person capitulated en masse to this offense against civil liberties. And I think that history, we're not surprised at what George W. Bush does. We're not surprised at who Ashcroft was. That's how come black folk in Missouri in 2000 turned out in record numbers to vote for the dead guy against Ashcroft. We knocked him out of the Senate, but Bush then put him in charge of our legal system. Ashcroft and Bush are acting the way they do because they believe in a reactionary body of politics. The Democratic Party, which ostensibly represents the alternative, represents no alternative. And so the real challenge for progressives and left-of-center politics in this country is to reframe a politics, the possibilities of a left politics that transcend this kind of Tweedledum and Tweedledee framing of issues. And that's a real problem for us. And I think the only way that we can begin to address that is to focus on concrete issues that have touched people's lives. The fact that there's something profoundly dangerous where you can use secret information to indict people, where there are thousands of people being held by the security apparatuses of our government who have not been charged with any crime, whether they are documented immigrants or undocumented immigrants, really doesn't matter a whole lot, because in the last analysis, the chickens will come home to roost. You destroy the democratic rights for some residents in the country, you will inevitably restrict the democratic rights of others who are citizens. And so these are the kinds of issues and concerns we need to raise with the American people.
You know, Janice, those are the precise things that I'm talking about. You know, this man, and when you sent the email blast out about what the topic would be this evening, and you know what my first response was? Who? That was my first.
That thought for a minute, Alpho? Our chat room at Blog Talk Radio is now open.
Oh.
It's now working.
I still got
For those of you who are just joining us, you're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. You can join us at blogtalkradio.com/OCG. We had some spirited conversation with Aronde, and we thank him for his call because he sees inside of these issues. And sometimes, and most of the times, Aronde is ahead of us. And what I'm trying to do is get people all on the same page. And then we had some a call from Hugh, who happened to have been fortunate enough to meet and to hear Dr. Manning Marable live. Thank you for that, Alpha. I just wanted to let people know the chat room is open.
Well, I'm glad the chat room is open because I had given up on the name. I was getting the chat room up, but I couldn't click on it. I couldn't scroll it. I couldn't do anything to it. It was just frozen.
Okay.
So
okay.
I'll visit the chat room with you. I don't know what the deal is here. But.
Okay, so let's get back to your point that you were making.
Well, my whole, well, like I said, when you put his name up, and I'm saying to myself, who is that? I had never heard of this man. And I mean, I'm not skittish or standoffish about my ignorance. I cop to what I am. But this is a man, and this is where we lose. We lose the fact that nobody of, I would say, close proximity to this man felt a need to get him. I mean, he's like you say, he's been out there on C-SPAN, CNN, the whole nine yards. But
Manning was a guest at Our Common Ground very frequently before there was the internet. And his lectures and his speaking engagements were wide and varied. And he was part of academia, and he's been writing books for he's written 21 books in the last 30 years, books that are important, books on black leadership, books on black politics, books on our history. Race Reform and Rebellion is one of his books that he wrote. In most of the black newspapers across the country carried his column along the color lines. He has written 200 articles in academic journals and edited volumes. He has if you really want, in 2005 is when he started writing this book. And he revealed some stunning new information on the assassination of Malcolm X and his plans to unite the civil rights and black nationalist movements, and the three missing chapters from the autobiography of Malcolm X. And that was back in 2005. He was a guest at Democracy Now!, and you still can find, I have posted on Our Common Ground website at Ning, you can find that interview. Let Nobody Turn Us Around is another of his wonderful, wonderful books of both commentary and history. The Malcolm X project at Columbia has been begging for money for years. So one of the things that we have to become, Alpha, is we have to become serious. Serious students of our state and of our history and of our going forward. We really do. I just couldn't imagine that no one would really know the work of Manning Marable, which is as important or even more important than W.E.B. Du Bois and Frederick Douglass. And I hate to make those comparisons as important. He was this country's leading historian. I mean, one of the things, too, one of his closest friends was Dr. Michael Eric Dyson. And Dr. Ron Walters and Ron Daniels. He was the kind of person who would pick up the phone and call you and say, look, I've got this panel for students that I'm doing next week. Can you come down and spend a couple of hours with some of the black students at Columbia? So I'm just I'm hoping that people will start reading his work as a result of this broadcast. You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Graham, along with my co-host Alpho of the Alpho Show, and we had our programming this week was focused on youth prisons and juvenile justice in America, and I promise you that we will get through that entire thing on our next broadcast next Saturday night at 10 p.m., but we'll begin it tonight. We're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll start talking about it. It has been my honor to be able to remember a friend of our people, Dr. Manning Marable.
You've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked, bamboozled, led astray, run on.
Frankie, what's happening?
Yeah, man, look here. Something funky is going down, man.
What do you mean something funky going down?
Oh, man, I'm over here working. Yeah.
Our Common Ground. Talk that matters. I'm Janice Graham, and I'll be listening for you. Tonight, in our second page, we're talking about juvenile crime and punishment. It can be different from the types of punishments that are ordered in adult prisons and criminal cases. For those of you who might be interested, the first court established especially for juveniles was built in Chicago in 1899 to address the issue of juvenile crime and punishment. It peaked in about 1994, and the 1990s saw a swell of public scrutiny over the perceived juvenile crime epidemic. In an effort to crack down on juvenile crime and punishment, many state legislatures have developed harsher laws regarding juvenile crime. Now, Alpha, to me, that doesn't make any sense.
Well, let me say this. And I'm going to say this. It's radical. Oh, it's radical. But let me say this. Just as the radical evangelist Christians target abortion doctors with the publishing of their names, their addresses, their telephone numbers, their license plate numbers, the car, kind of cars they drive, I feel the same should be done about those who oversee and privatize these prisons for profit, who mistreat and dish out and mete out punishment in a disparaging way. I think that there should be one of the answers to this type of new Jim Crow, these new nigger breakers, should be a targeting of these people who are responsible all the way from coast to coast, all the way from this Russell Pierce in Arizona, who is sponsoring and the governor and all of these people who've been pushing to privatize these prisons. You know, prisoners have.
Well, let me just say this, that prisons are filled with stress and violence, and they can revert to primitive places, as reported by NPR, and that's what happened at Walnut Grove Youth Correctional Facility in Mississippi. It is the largest juvenile prison in the country. It houses 1,200 boys and young men in a one-story complex in an hour's drive east of Jackson. The state of Mississippi pays a private corrections company to run the prison. And what we're going to do is take a look at NPR's investigation around allegations that the prison raises in a fundamental question of whether profits have distorted the mission of rehabilitating young inmates. And there are also questions in my mind as to whether or not the mission was real in the first place. Here's the report.
You're listening to Our Common Ground. In the second page, a discussion about youth prisons, penalty and profit. Is there all that it is? And who pays the price?
The U.S. has the highest incarceration rate in the world, and that has helped make privately run prisons a $3 billion industry. You'll find the nation's largest juvenile prison in a tiny Mississippi town, and it's become a golden goose for the community and for its private operator. But a scandal there is raising serious questions about whether profits have distorted the mission of rehabilitation. A civil rights lawsuit alleges juvenile inmates are being held in barbaric and unconstitutional conditions, and the Justice Department is looking into it. Here's NPR's John Burnett with the first of a two-part investigation. The state of Mississippi pays a private corrections company to run the nation's largest juvenile prison. Walnut Grove Youth Correctional Facility houses 1,200 boys and young men in a sprawling one-story complex ringed by security fences about an hour's drive east of Jackson. Prisons are places filled with stress and violence. Without proper supervision, they can revert to primitive places. Our investigation indicates that's what has happened at Walnut Grove.
Walnut Grove, it started out and it was formed to be something good for youth, but somewhere down the line, it took a turn for the worse.
Claiborne Henderson is 27. He's working at a car wash and taking community college courses, trying to straighten his life out. He spent 2 years for kidnapping in the Grove, as they call it, between his 19th and 21st birthdays. He and other former inmates who were interviewed in a lawyer's office describe an environment of violence inside the youth prison that was so pervasive it became entertainment.
It'd be like setting up a fight deal like you would with two dogs. And at some time that I did witness twice while I was at Walnut Grove, they actually betted on it. it was payday for the guards, and they actually bid it on two fights.
The Southern Poverty Law Center and the ACLU National Prison Project have filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of 13 inmates against the prison operator, GEO Group, and state officials. The complaint describes rampant contraband brought in by guards, sex between female guards and male inmates, inadequate medical care, prisoners held inhumanely in isolation, and guards brutalizing inmates. Sheila Betty is the lead attorney on the case.
And when we began investigating conditions inside of the facility and seeing how these kids were living with the beatdowns and the sexual abuse and the violence and the corruption, it became a no-brainer. It became something that we had to do.
Earlier this year, the Justice Department Civil Rights Division launched its own investigation into some of the charges. A spokesperson in Washington said the probe is ongoing, and she declined to comment. Several former inmates who spoke to NPR say the guards are a big part of the problem. Justin Bowling spent 17 months in the Grove in 2007 and 2008 for marijuana possession. He says the prison is overrun with gangs whose members include correctional officers.
A lot of times the guards are in the same gang. If the inmates wanted something done, they got it. If they wanted a cell popped open to handle some business about fighting or something like that, it just pretty much happened.
There's also a problem of too few guards. A state audit in 2005 and another one last year noted that staffing at Walnut Grove decreased even as the prisoner population increased. In prison, less supervision leads to more assaults. The Council of Juvenile Correctional Administrators, which represents youth facilities in all 50 states, reports that a ratio of one guard to 10 or 12 inmates is common. The audit of Walnut Grove found the guard-to-inmate ratio was 1 to 60. Salaries are the largest expense of a correctional budget, and reducing staffing is often a way to keep costs down. GEO Group, based in Boca Raton, Florida, declined repeated requests by NPR to give its side of the story. They cited the pending lawsuit. GEO is the nation's second largest prison corporation, with more than $1 billion in revenue last year. Mississippi Corrections Commissioner Chris Epps also declined repeated requests for an interview, citing the litigation. In a short email, he said the facility is improving under GEO's management and he has no knowledge of staff abusing inmates. 2 months later, his spokesperson confirmed they've hired an independent consultant to review operations at the Grove.
We know that our children have made mistakes. You know, we know that we're not asking that they open the cell doors and let our kids out. We're asking for them to have better treatment.
Ethel Hurd is one of 100 parents who've banded together to pressure the state to make reforms at Walnut Grove. Her 21-year-old son, Tyrone, is serving time there for armed robbery. When Walnut Grove opened 10 years ago, it was a model youth facility. The idea was to get teenaged felons out of the notorious Parchman Penitentiary and away from hardened criminals. As one young inmate said, an old fool has lived his life, but a young fool can change. But that's not how it's turned out, says State Representative John Mayo. He's a member of the Corrections Committee that oversees Walnut Grove.
To me, in my mind, it's just a prison. Another adult prison.
Mayo says the legislature kept raising the age of inmates sent there from 18, now all the way up to 22. He voted against the age increases. Today, Walnut Grove is the only juvenile facility in the nation that locks up 22-year-olds with 13-year-olds.
Initially, it was to be 13 through 18-year-olds. And then, quite frankly, that did not populate Walnut Grove to what I'm going to call a profitable operation.
2 years ago, Walnut Grove added 500 beds to accommodate all the new prisoners. According to the 2008 and 2009 annual reports for Cornell Companies, the prison operator at the time, the expansion created an extra $3.4 million in revenue. GEO acquired Cornell last year. George Cole, a career educator, served as principal of the prison school for 4 years. Here's his testimony at a legislative hearing called in January to look into alleged abuses at the prison.
I thought when I went to Walnut Grove I was going to go to a place that really was interested in the rehabilitation of our children, but I found out quite the opposite. And I guess as a private facility, they had to make money.
NPR examined hundreds of pages of public records associated with federal grants paid to Walnut Grove. Records show that Warden Brick Tripp and his deputy wardens, already paid by GEO, have been receiving checks for $2,500 to $5,000 as supplemental salaries for administering federal education funds. Yet former Principal George Cole, contacted at his home, said this.
The warden and deputy warden had no dealing whatsoever with educating students.
The warden declined an interview request. A lawyer representing the Walnut Grove Correctional Authority, which writes the checks, says overseeing the grants is part of the warden's job, though he did not say why deputy wardens receive paycheck bonuses. NPR forwarded the paycheck supplements to the U.S. Department of Education and asked for an explanation. Chief of Communications Justin Hamilton said they're concerned.
And we referred this matter to the Department of Education's Inspector General for investigation.
Despite all the controversy, the youth prison has staunch defenders. Denise Jones Putnam, the municipal clerk of the town of Walnut Grove, says her nephew is in the prison boot camp program.
And he will be one of the first ones to tell you that's the best thing that's ever happened to him. It's turned his life totally around. What I think about the facility is it offers a place for these kids to be rehabilitated and put back into society.
As to why the kids are frequently placed on lockdown and fight with staff, Reverend Justin Cheney was chaplain at Walnut Grove from 2007 to 2010.
Walnut Grove's not a daycare. I'm afraid that's what a lot of people kind of think it might be. It's just a little detention center. That's maximum security. So, yeah, you do have those that can be rough.
The town of Walnut Grove is so small, there's no stoplight or supermarket. Inmates outnumber citizens 2-1. The youth prison has just about saved this town from extinction. The 200 prison jobs helped fill the void when a shirt manufacturer and a glove maker closed and moved overseas several years ago.
My name is Grady Sims, mayor of Walnut Grove, been the mayor for about 30 years.
The mayor's own vending company has 18 snack machines inside the prison.
It's been a sweet deal for Walnut Grove.
Every month, the prison pays the town $15,000 in lieu of taxes, which comprises nearly 15% of its annual budget.
For a small town, that's a lot of money. You know, and it helps us maintain a full-time police department that we wouldn't be able to afford without that income.
There's more. GEO pays the Walnut Grove Correctional Authority, which sends the prison all of its grant money, $4,500 a month. The authority's lawyer says the money is kept in escrow and rarely spent. Finally, there's a full-time state corrections employee whose job is to monitor how the prison is run. His salary is reimbursed by GEO. All of this raises the question, is oversight of the Walnut Grove Youth Correctional Facility negligent because it's a golden goose? Here's what Representative Earl Banks, chairman of the State Juvenile Justice Committee, had to say. He's the one who called the recent hearing to investigate Walnut Grove. He's also a plaintiff's lawyer who's suing the prison for wrongful death of an inmate.
All this community is just making so much money on Walnut Grove that no one wants to upset the apple cart. Then that means they're not going to make the money anymore.
That may be about to change. Again, Representative John Mayo.
There's mistreatment going on at Walnut Grove, and the Justice Department finds that it is. They ought to sue the hell out of somebody. I can't understand why we have to be sued to do what's right.
John Burnett, NPR News.
And on Monday's morning edition, you can hear the second half of John's investigation.
And on next week, you will hear the second part of this investigative report. Our number is 347-838-9852. And my question is, to what extent is this sweet deal for the town of Walnut Grove, Mississippi, an hour's drive east of Jackson, placing profit and penalty and further damage on the backs of our children? I wanted to introduce this subject, and I apologize to everyone for the problems we've had with the chat room tonight, but this is something that we should not stand for. In this investigative report, we are hearing the real story. Did you hear the former inmate say a lot of times the guards are in the same gang? If the inmates wanted something done, they got it. If they wanted to sell, popped open to handle some business about fighting or something like that, it just pretty much happened. The Council of Juvenile Correctional Administrators, whose members represent youth facilities in all 50 states, reports that a guard-to-inmate ratio of 1 officer to 10 or 12 juvenile prisoners is common. In the state audit of Walnut Grove, they found that the guard-to-inmate ratio to be 1 to 60. And here we have, once again, this inept Mississippi Corrections Commissioner Chris Epps, who does not know what time it is, and if he does know what time it is, he repeatedly requests interviews, citing litigation, and he brings a cover story for the state. Many of you may not be aware, but on Thursday, Governor Haley Barbour of Mississippi announced that he would not be issuing a pardon for the Scott sisters. So they will be on indefinite suspension for the rest of their lives. We really thank you for being with us tonight, and on next Saturday night, we will spend the 2 hours with both experts and more of this investigative report on Walnut Grove, as well as some other information on youth prisons. We are allowing our tax dollars. Also, these are our tax dollars going into these prisons that provide no rehabilitation. The whole point is for profit, for both the state and the for-profit corporations that run these facilities, that build and run these facilities. And you heard the mayor saying it was a sweet deal for the city, for the town. Juveniles are no better off in youth facilities than they would be in adult facilities. Sexual victimization in juvenile facilities reported by youth in 2008 and 2009 are increasing every day, not only by youth on youth sexual contact, but by staff sexual misconduct. We need to look at the indicators of school crime and safety and come up with another way, and we need to demand that youth prisons are centers of education and rehabilitation. Thank you all for being with us tonight. I'm Janice Graham, and Alpha, my co-host, thank you for joining me. And we will see you on Monday at TruthWorks Power Views, where we will be covering an interview with Michael Eric Dyson on the death of Dr. Manning Marable. Be safe. Be critical in what news you digest this week.
When I'm alone with my fancies,
thank you for being with us here at Our Common Ground. I'm Janice Graham, along with my co-host, Alpha, of The Alpha Show. We thank you for being with us. We thank you for your calls, your comments in our chat room, and your emails. We'll be here right back on Saturday next, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, speaking truth to power and ourselves. What you belong to our common ground.
Against the ability. I'm alone with my fancies. I'll be with you, weaving romances, making believe the truth. Oh, give me lips for just a moment, and my imagination will make that moment live. Oh, give me what you alone can give. I'll give the bill of dreams.